Hello, and welcome to Sideways. This week, we start off talking about centre halves and end up on the subject of suicide. But stick with it. It's important.
So, what?
are you going to kick off?
So, what are we talking about this week?
Well, I've been listening to quite a few different podcasts. I like to listen to different podcasts because it, not only just to see how that sort of editing's, how that's done, how it comes out, etc. But I think there are some good podcasts about. There's some quite bad ones as well. But I think sifting through those, you come across one or two little gems. And it's one or two little lines that come up and you think, oh, that's really good. Why? And that should have been explored a bit more. One that I've particularly liked this week, which the link to it was on our Aspire to Be Facebook page. Mm-hmm. One of our administrators, he puts links on regularly for different things. The BBC podcast, which the link was to, was called Hooked.
Oh, yeah.
And it's been running for a little while now, and I've listened to some of them. I particularly liked the one that the link was this week to, because Tony Adams was on there, and I remember Tony Adams, don't we, from the 80s and the 90s?
Old England centre-half.
I mean, not being an Arsenal fan, I don't want to big him up too much. I'm sure we used to give him a little bit of stick from the terraces, didn't we?
Yeah, well,
Different places.
Because he was good.
He was good, yeah. And that was a problem, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was a problem that he was good, and he was good at a young age.
Yeah.
And I think as we do tend to, we like to knock those sort of people down, don't we?
Well, in this country, you do.
In this country, very much so. But anyway, Tony Adams, I've got a lot of respect for him, particularly what he's done and the way he dealt with his addiction and the way he dealt with his alcoholism. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of similarities because Tony and I obviously were both centre-halves in their time. You know? The similarities don't end there. I know he went on to play for England, but...
You're both not very attractive.
Very ugly. Yeah. But we both played centre-half. He played for England, I played... quite a long time for the Royal George Pub.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Very similar. But the similarities are also with regards to the drift into addiction. But there's one phrase he used, which was sort of almost glossed over by the person who was interviewing him, or the two girls that were interviewing him. The phrase he used, and it was used to describe how the desperation you feel when you're right down in those pits of despair. And the phrase he used was, you get to the point where you don't know how to kill yourself and you don't know how to live.
Okay.
All right? Which is a nice in and out at that point, isn't it? That really is your rock bottom point. And I really related to that. Mm-hmm. Because there's no... you can't hide from the fact that virtually everyone that goes into recovery that I've come across has had suicidal thoughts.
Yeah.
I certainly had them. I was very near to attempting it. A lot of people that come into groups and the people that I deal with and know in the recovery circles have tried, mm-hmm. Some on several occasions. I've known a couple of people that have been successful, which is quite desperate, mm-hmm. that they weren't able to get away and get away from this desperation. And I thought that phrase was quite a... It's quite pointless. It's quite a short phrase, but you don't know how to kill yourself, but you don't know how to live. What do you think about that as a phrase?
Well, it's an interesting play on a conversation that I've often had with clients over the years, where people will effectively say, "It's not that I want to kill myself. It's just that I don't want to live anymore."
Yeah.
And I think, to me, what Tony Adams is saying is something similar. It's like, it's not that I have a desire to kill myself. I just can't see any point of still being here and living. So I understand that. I can understand. I've seen that often. It's actually quite rare that someone will say, I really want to kill myself. You know, that's almost in a very a kind of self-loathing manner. Sometimes people can be quite aggressive in their suicidal thoughts,
yeah.
towards themselves. But more often, that feeling of wanting to die is about just not wanting to live. I mean, how did you feel when you got to that point?
I felt that there's no, I felt there's no way out from where I was sitting at that point. Mm-hmm. Emotionally, I was completely drained.
Yeah.
I had no relationships with anyone around me. Mm-hmm. They'd broken down terribly with my children,
yeah.
My family, my friends. The isolation, which I so desperately craved so that I could indulge my addiction, also led on to this, to these terrible thoughts, terrible, terrible thoughts that wouldn't go away. They kept cropping up. I remember going round to the different shops. I would go out and go to different shops and buy the maximum amount of paracetamol that you were allowed to buy.
Mm-hmm.
And I repeated that. It almost gave me a focus. It was really weird because I felt almost quite happy doing that because I was actually doing something, which was, it wasn't positive. The end wasn't going to be positive, but it gave me something to do almost.
Yeah.
It almost meant I was doing something.
Well, that's the other thing that people will often speak about when they have decided that they want to kill themselves. There can be a kind of sense of release, a relief that at least now I know what's going to happen. Now I don't have to feel anxious anymore. I don't have to feel stressed anymore because I've concluded that this is the best way forward, which, you know, is terribly tragic. But if you're in a situation where you feel that there really isn't any alternative, nowhere to turn, you don't feel as if you have any options, then you can kind of understand that when someone says, oh, that's what I'll do, that's my out, it kind of makes a kind of tragic sense.
Yeah, it does. It does make a tragic sense. But it's, I think, because with addiction, because your mind is so fuzzy at that time anyway, whichever your drug of choice is, you're not thinking straight.
Mm.
And you really can't see that there is an alternative.
Yeah.
You're either going to have to continue with this absolute misery you're in, or you're going to have to die. And I think that recovery, to me, was finding out, the joy of recovery was finding out that there is another alternative. You don't have to go down that route.
Mm. I mean, we've spoken before, haven't we, about one of the things that keeps people in addiction is the lack of true, you know, deep belief that there can be anything beyond it.
There's certainly a lack of belief that there's life beyond drink or life beyond drugs or the life that you're potentially would go to in recovery is going to be awful without these things in your life.
Mm.
So experience shows nothing can be further from the truth.
Yeah. I mean, if at that time when you felt suicidal, if someone had said to you, you know, if you'd told anyone that you felt like that and they'd said to you, well, have you thought about how you're going to do it? It sounds like your answer to that would have been yes. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And because, you know, if someone comes to me and says, I'm feeling suicidal, I'm planning to kill myself, then all of your instincts kind of scream that you kind of want to get away from that subject to stop them thinking about it. But actually what you have to do is you have to step straight into it and ask them to talk about it. So ask them to tell you how they're going to do it, how they've planned to do it.
Is that what you just said to me? If I'd have come along and told you that, so I asked you that.
I would have done. I'd have asked you if you'd planned it and what stage you'd got to with your planning. I would have asked you, have you thought about who's going to find you? Had you thought about that?
No.
Right. Do you think that would have made a difference if you had?
No. No, not really.
Tell me about that.
I don't really think
it would have made a difference to you.
I think
of just where you were at that point.
It is where you're at, but you're at that point where you think, and this comes up a lot in groups as well, when people do get to that point, your frame of mind is, everyone's going to be better off without me anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it doesn't really matter. The impact of finding me is going to be less than the impact of me not being there and me being a burden upon them. So,
but do you think,
which selfishly it wouldn't have entered my mind.
But do you think? I mean, obviously you can't know with retrospect, but I wonder if being forced to confront that idea and think about who it was that would have found you, and having the opportunity to have that view that everyone would be better off without you challenged, I wonder if that might have made a difference to you. I mean, it may not have made a difference to you in the depths of, you know, where you were.
I think it would have put, I think anything at that stage would have been difficult to get through to me that there was an alternative.
I mean, I think that's true generally of people who are suicidal. You know, I can't think of many occasions where I've had that conversation with people, and when I've asked them, you know, when I've had a conversation with them about how people will feel after they're dead, you know, almost everybody says, well, everyone will be better off. I mean, the phrase that people most often use, even when they're talking about their own children, is they'll get over it.
Oh, I don't think I've heard that one.
Yeah.
No, it certainly wouldn't have been something that... but again, the consequences are almost irrelevant, really, at that stage.
Yeah, they are to the person who's feeling suicidal.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, yeah.
On the other... As someone who's worked with a lot of people who are grieving a suicide, nobody ever gets over a suicide. No. You can't get over a death, but a suicide, there's a particularly visceral, sustained pain that comes from that.
There is, and as I said earlier on, I have known two people where they have been successful in their attempts. And knowing now, having seen the absolute devastation, the funerals are really awful. The awful part of it is seeing the family around them and how it is affecting them. I don't think, you know, having gone through that and got to where I am now, there's no way that I would go down that route again. There's no way, unless I lapsed and went back to my old habits and therefore had a messed up mind, there's no way I could ever contemplate leaving that sort of carnage behind.
Yeah.
Because it really is, it's awful. I remember on one occasion, one of the funerals I went to, I'm not quite sure why they decided to do it, but they read out part of his suicide note. It was... The reason that it was read out, he'd actually requested it as well, that this would be read out at his funeral. So he knew what he was doing at this stage. And it was really to his fellow people in recovery to stay strong. And it was, there was not a dry eye in the house at that time, and it had a real impact upon me.
What impact did that have? I mean, for someone to have killed themselves and to leave a message behind them telling everyone else to stay strong, I'm wondering what impact that had on you and what impact you feel like it had on other people.
I was devastated at the time. Hearing it, it didn't really sink in. I didn't really want to think about it for quite some time afterwards, really. I was grieving about this person going, because he was such a nice guy. We used to run groups together. I didn't see it coming. It was one of those things. I'm sure that happens with everyone goes through it at this point, is why couldn't I have done something else? Why didn't he ask me? But then again, when I was had suicidal tendencies, the last thing I was going to do was to actually tell someone, which we all recommend you do, but I wouldn't have done it. And so I could understand it from that point of view, but to organise it to the extent where the suicide note was left, and then there were... it was to be read out at the funeral, was just bizarre. But it did have a marked impact upon the way I saw things. It had an impact on the way I saw how these things pan out.
Yeah, I mean, the acknowledgement that when you feel like that, you don't tell anyone, is perhaps one of the main reasons why, if you feel that someone is suicidal or they're giving any indication that they are, that's why it's so important to ask them about it, because people will rarely venture, you know, or volunteer that information to you and say, do you know what, I'm feeling like I want to kill myself.
No, they
might drop a few hints, you know, it'd be better if I wasn't here and such like, you know. And so if anybody, do you ever hear that in group? Do you ever hear people talking like that?
What, suicidal?
Well, just, you know, even not necessarily saying, I feel like I want to kill myself, but those sorts of little tells that people have, you know, it'd probably be better if I wasn't here at all. You know, those sorts of... what happens in a kind of peer support group when people are saying...
Everyone,
it's quite difficult.
It is quite difficult, but because so many people have empathy with that situation, can relate to it, people tend to rally around and say, look, stick with the programme, because things your mind is going to get clearer. You won't feel like this in a week's time. You won't feel like this in a month's time. But you put the work in, these thoughts, you look back upon the thoughts you're having now as a mere blip.
Yeah.
And you won't find it as intimidating as it is now. Mm-hmm. In fact, it would make you a little bit stronger as you go through. But I think getting people to talk about stuff is really tricky anyway. One of the things we always advocate is for, if someone's in recovery, certainly in the early stages, if they do feel they've got a craving come along, or they're starting to feel their resolve starting to crumble, is to ring someone.
Mm.
Okay, now that is one of the most difficult things to do. Again, it's that asking for help effective at that time. But when you analyse it, because a lot of people do it, the reason they don't ring someone is because they don't want to get talked out of it. And because I know as soon as they've rung someone and said, I fancy a drink, you know, things are really bad, I really need to have a drink. If someone starts to talk sense into them, it means then they've sort of committed to that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you don't ring anyone, you can make up your own mind and you can then give yourself permission to go and have a drink.
Mm-hmm.
So getting people to ring each other is really tough. I really struggled with it.
Did you do it?
Yeah, I did. I did do it, but I only did it once, and I didn't admit to that person while I was ringing. But it didn't really matter, because all you're needing to do at that point is to take yourself away from that moment. We know
it's a distraction for the craving.
Yeah, it is, because we know cravings last for a certain amount of time. They always reckon it lasts 7 minutes. Now, to me, that was way under forecast. Mine is good, it would last for an awful long time. But as time went on, if a craving did come along, yeah, it would last for a few minutes and then it would go away. So I just needed to fill that gap. And by ringing someone, even if it wasn't to say, I'm feeling a bit poorly, I need to talk to someone about it, just taking yourself away from that point of view, just talking to anyone about anything, it tended to work. But I only did it on the one occasion, and I found after that I was starting to get my own strength. So it's quite a long way down the line when I did actually ring someone.
Mm.
But because I'd been in recovery at that point for probably 3 or 4 months, I'd started to rationalise things myself a little bit and knew ringing was the right thing to do. Whereas before, I would probably thought, I want to leave this door open back to my old lifestyle.
Yeah, because that suggests that part of recovery is developing the strength to understand that sometimes you lack the strength that you need.
Yes, yeah.
Because that's what, you know, so when you realise, when you have enough humility to kind of know, actually, I'm struggling a little bit now, I'm far enough into my recovery to realise that I need to ask for help, then perhaps that's the time that it becomes easier for you to pick up the phone. And
yeah, it does. It's strange, isn't it? It is strange.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Is it strange? Really, recovery is about self-awareness, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And so the more self-aware we become, the easier it becomes for us to know what we need.
True.
And theoretically, the easier it is for us to ask for it. You know, I often say to people, the most difficult part of therapy is coming in the first place. You know, once you've made that decision, you've stepped over the threshold and you start telling someone your story, you know, that's the hardest bit. You've started. And I guess with recovery, it's the same thing, isn't it? The hardest part is to begin it.
It certainly is. It's certainly the hard work is done in the first few weeks of recovery, certainly. But the even harder is to start that, to get to day one of recovery, which can take an awful long time. It can take years to get to day one. So it's something that, you know, we have to just be aware of, certainly, yeah.
Mm.
But it's been quite... we got a bit heavy there, haven't we?
Not really.
Yeah,
it's quite important, isn't it?
It's very important.
Although I would have to say that we haven't really spoken very much about centre-halves.
We haven't talked about centre-halves. I mean, that was the sort of the original reason we were going to talk about this,
wasn't
it? It was. Because Tony Adams being a centre-half and me being a centre-half,
yeah.
We thought that
in case we'd forgotten.
Yeah.
Do you remember my goal at Railway Rovers in Waterbury?
I do remember that.
Were you playing centre half that day?
I was playing centre half that day. But I think, I mean, I did spend times playing in other positions, but certainly I think I spent a lot of my. As you get older, you drift back in the team anyway, didn't you? As a youngster, I was trying to knock in goals all the time because that's the great part about football. But as you get older and a little bit slower, you drift back into centre half. So I suspect by the time you scored your solitary goal for Royal George, I suspect it had taken so long to get there, I'd have drifted well back to centre. I was probably in goal or on the bench, to be honest.
No, you were definitely playing that game.
Yeah, I was playing that game.
Definitely playing that game. Yeah, it was my only goal for the Royal Jubilee.
Yeah, but well, I had dozens. But there we go. That's
okay. Good. So,
but just one last little thing, all right? Just to change again, that came up on the podcast was that someone described sobriety as being like life in high def.
Oh, right,
LHD. Yeah, I thought I liked that. I think it's quite a nice thing to end it on. That's a nice little phrase to end this on this podcast on, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Think about it, because I think I went from a very fuzzy
black and white picture,
yeah, into colour, and then into HD, and I think I'm pretty much in 4K now. So I'm
To be honest, I preferred you in black and white.
Yeah, I was preferred in black and white. Life was black and white in the '60s.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, see you next time.
Cheers, will do.
Bye.
Bye.
Sideways was created by Graham Landy and Martin Pankhurst. If you want to read more about our work, visit grahamlandywellbeing.co.uk/sideways. You can follow us on Twitter, and you can send us an email if you want to let us know what you think about the show or with any questions that you might have. And we want to thank you for listening, and ask that if you've enjoyed what you've heard, that you tell someone. And we'll see you next week.